are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Everything I learned in a Chinese restaurant, by Curtis Chin. This book was reviewed by Elizabeth Egan. As Curtis Chin got ready to talk about his memoir, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant, waiters in powder blue jackets delivered steaming platters of lo mein and bok choy to tables full of readers. It was just another Wednesday night at Hop Key, a 56-year-old pillar of Manhattan's Chinatown. But this was no ordinary book event. It was the sixth stop on Chin's For Here or to Go tour, a 14-city blitz celebrating both his book and family-owned Chinese restaurants like Chung's, the one his great-grandfather opened in Detroit in 1940. "Guess how many egg rolls we sold in 65 years?" Chin asked the crowd. The dining room rang with guesses. "A half a million, 2 million, a billion, trillion." 10 million, Chin said proudly, "all handmade by my mother, my grandmother, and my aunties." When Chin, 56, was growing up as the third of six children, his mother told him to work hard, obey his elders, and be quiet. His father's advice was more unconventional. "Talk to strangers." He was referring to the customers at Chung's, where the family spent 80 hours a week. Chin's dishy and conversational memoir satisfies as many cravings as the restaurant it celebrates. It's a coming-of-age story, a time capsule of Detroit in the 1980s, and a love letter to the place where Chin collected the ingredients for the life he has now. "My mom didn't graduate high school. My dad went to community college for 2 semesters, Chin said. "They didn't know the world outside our Chinese restaurant, but they had a dining room full of people who did." Every time Chin's parents struck up a conversation with an interesting customer, they'd summon their children. "We'd barrage them with questions," he said. "What do you do for a living? How did you get your job? How much money do you make?" Chung's taught him many lessons, Chin said. "Don't be afraid of talking to people who are different. Don't be afraid of asking questions. Don't be afraid of asking for help." Now he's paying forward what he learned there. Since his memoir came out last year, he's embarked on a marathon, self-organized tour involving 300 book talks in 5 countries. But his favorite events are the ones he holds in Chinese restaurants. "Behind every restaurant, there's a story," Chin said. "I'm trying to give restaurant owners a chance to tell their story." In the book, Chin recalls the Chung's diners who made the biggest impressions. There was Yul Brynner, touring with the King and I, who snubbed the family by declining to pose for a Polaroid. There was Coleman Young, Detroit's first black mayor, who encouraged Chin to pay attention to what made him angry, then figure out how to fix it. There was Bob Vito, bureau chief of CNN, who steered Chin towards journalism. And finally, there was the gay couple, a doctor and a lawyer, who reassured Chin's mother and father after he came out of the closet. "They filled my parents' heads with stereotypes about gay people," Chin said. "For instance, he's going to have a fabulous apartment, and he's going to go to the theater. After that, my parents were totally fine. I think they were just worried I'd have a difficult life." The restaurant was in a rough neighborhood, Chin said, at the peak of the crack epidemic. The sex trade was brisk on the streets outside Chung's. Racial tensions simmered. Vincent Chin, an honorary cousin, was murdered by 2 white auto workers who blamed immigrants for the decline of the auto industry. Chin's family found a slur carved in fresh concrete outside their suburban home. "Even more hurtful," Chin writes, "a letter slipped beneath the front door stated that the delivery van parked in the driveway was below community standards." Chung's became a refuge where Chin worked tirelessly, if not always enthusiastically. Banished from the kitchen because of poor cooking skills, he folded napkins, did his homework, and chatted with guests in the dining room. He also learned to pay attention. In time, Chin went to the University of Michigan, where he landed a coveted spot in the creative writing program. He was as nervous to tell his parents about his literary aspirations as he was to announce his sexual orientation, he said. They handled both in stride. In his 20s, he co-founded the Asian American Writers Workshop, then worked in television, first as a comedy writer, then as a producer of social justice documentaries. I never felt the pressure to get published, he said. I helped all these writers find their voice. I felt this was my life's legacy. That changed when Chin's siblings started having children. I thought, my God, they're not going to know anything about the Michigan Asian American experience, he said. When you look at Asian American history, it's always told from the perspective of California, New York, or Hawaii. They don't really talk about Michigan. Chin made a list of around 30 stories he wanted to keep in the family. He started fleshing them out in an email to himself, then realized he was writing a book, a family comedy featuring restaurant capers and sibling rivalries. He approached 90 agents. A third of them never responded. Another third wrote back and said, "Thanks, but no thanks," Chin recalled. A percentage of the final group said they loved the characters, but wouldn't be able to sell the book. He went back to the agents who'd liked his writing and said, "I'm also going to talk about the coming out process. I'm going to talk about the racism I experienced. Once I did that, I had 4 offers." Vivian Lee, Chin's editor at Little Brown, said she was drawn to Chin's idea of structuring the book like a Chinese menu, beginning with the tea, progressing through soup, noodles, and entrees, and ending with the fortune cookie. Each section has 8 chapters because 8 is a lucky number in Chinese culture. Lee praised Chin's uncanny ability to create community wherever he goes, and to generate momentum for everything I learned in a Chinese restaurant at a time when readings can be poorly attended and dispiriting, especially for a debut author. I hear stories about the difficulties local Chinese restaurants have been facing, particularly post-COVID, Chin said, noting the rise of anti-Asian violence and the challenges of the food industry in general. I thought, maybe I can use the platform I have because of this book to raise awareness and to help. Jeff Kim, Chin's husband of 16 years, said, "It's not just about him now. It's about the whole history of Chinese restaurants and how they've touched so many lives." At Hop Key, guests passed dumplings and poured tumblers of tea. From a booth by the kitchen, You and Me Books, an independent store in Chinatown, sold stacks of Chin's rainbow-colored paperback, the only evidence that the event was more literary than culinary. The event was sponsored by the Lower East Side Preservation Initiative and the New York chapter of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy. The food bill at Chin's events usually comes to around $1,000, with all proceeds going to the venue. Chin spoke alongside Grace Lee, a New York State Assembly member representing Chinatown, Grace Young, a cookbook author and food historian, and Peter Lee, owner of Hop Key, who teared up while describing his struggle to stay afloat as neighborhood rents rise. "We have a history here," Lee said. "It's very difficult to maintain our culture and our heritage." Young noted the closing of several iconic Chinatown restaurants and the proliferation of bubble tea stores that charge for a single beverage what diners used to pay for an entire meal. "Restaurant owners have trouble finding employees who want to work in the neighborhood," Lee said. "They don't feel safe when they travel to work. Young chefs aren't drawn to places like Hop Key. The work is grueling, the hours long." Before the pandemic, the restaurant was open until 4 o'clock in the morning. Then Lee rolled back the closing time to 1 o'clock. Now the restaurant closes after dinner. "The difference of success and failure can be as few as 20 extra customers a week," Chin said. "That's what we're talking about here." One by one, audience members stood up and talked about what Chinese restaurants meant to them as gathering places, hubs of family life, ground zero for celebrations and reunions. 2 Detroit natives recalled childhood visits to Chung's. "I remember seeing kids from the owner's family doing homework. One of them was Curtis, Robert Turley said. The atmosphere was always so friendly. You could leave your cares at the door. Chung's closed in 2005 after Chin's parents were in a car accident that killed his father and left his mother seriously injured. Chin recalled cleaning the refrigerator, finding a bowl of fried rice, and realizing it was the last food he would ever eat that was made by his father. It was a really sad moment in my life, Chin said. Then he had a monumental choice to make. Do I stay in Detroit and take over this restaurant, or do I go back to Hollywood? He returned to the West Coast. He's tackling the aftermath of that decision in the memoir he's currently working on. It's called Leftovers. For now, Chin said, I'm gaining about 20 pounds on this tour, but it's worth it. The reviewer, Elizabeth Egan, grew up eating Chinese food at Alex Ng in South Orange, New Jersey. Now she frequently orders takeout from T.S. Ma in Montclair, New Jersey. Boneless spare ribs are her weakness. Four mysteries shot through with malice and grief. These four books were reviewed by Sarah Weinman. First book, The Rivals by Jane Peck. Peck's debut, The Verifiers, was the book I most wanted to review in 2022, but didn't. It wasn't perfect, but I admired the fresh, sweetly sardonic voice of the amateur sleuth and mystery novel aficionado Claudio Lynn, as well as the way Peck raised questions about living, dating, and lying online. The Rivals, published by Vintage, sees Claudia co-running Veracity, an online dating detective agency sussing out whether the people on matching platforms are lying about themselves. As she spars will-they-won't-they style with her business partner Bex and contends with her fractious family, Claudia grows increasingly alarmed at the cutthroat tactics of the matchmakers used by some of Veracity's clients. When one of those clients dies in a suspicious bike accident, Claudia tracks down his ex, who's employed by one of the aforementioned matchmakers, and convinces him to play double agent. Suddenly, Claudia's in a spy story, and so are readers, which allows Peck to have as much fun with genre tropes as she did in The Rivals. But beneath structural trickery and energetic prose lies the beating heart of human connection. Second book, Buried Road by Katie Tallow. Each mystery series installment is supposed to stand alone to give new readers a starting point no matter which book they pick up first. But in truth, this happens far less often than it should. But you don't need to have read the first two books in Tallow's wonderful series, Dark August and Poisoned Lilies, to enjoy Buried Road, published by Harper. Augusta Monet is 3 years into grieving her lost love, a journalist named Howard, who vanished while investigating a story. Her daughter, Bly, unspools the narrative, tasked with getting both herself and her mother through each day, a hard proposition for someone at any age, let alone a preteen. Then, Howard's camper van is discovered in an abandoned airport hangar, with evidence that his death was probably a homicide. Gus is shocked out of her lethargy and into white-hot fury. Bly asks her mother what could have happened to Howard. I know she doesn't know, but I ask before the question burns a hole in my chest. Gus turns to me. She's got that look. That's what we're going to find out, boo, she says. As Tallow directs the pair in unexpected directions, the languid pace picks up, propelling the narrative into heart-stopping thriller territory. Third book, Echo, by Tracy Clark. The Chicago detective Harriet Foster, making her third appearance in Clark's Echo, published by Thomas and Mercer, still operates in a fog after the deaths of her former partner and child. But Harry, as she's called, refuses to allow her pain to subsume her investigative work. The case she's just been assigned will definitely offer distraction. The death of Belverton College student and golden boy Bryce Collier, son of the school's biggest donor, found dead near campus. Bryce Collier died of fatal ethanol intoxication, meaning he consumed far more alcohol than his body could tolerate, the medical examiner tells Harry and her partner, before surprising them. This has happened before, 30 years ago, same field, same cause of death. Though that long-ago death was ruled a hazing accident, it turns out that Bryce's father and a friend, who happens to be Belverton's current president, was implicated in it. Clark's understanding of how the search for justice can be perverted into revenge is acute and informs the gasp-inducing conclusion. Fourth book, Trouble Island by Sharon Short. Oh, what tangled webs Short weaves in Trouble Island, published by Minotaur, which is rife with loss, bootlegging, betrayals, and double crosses. It's set on an island nestled in the center of Lake Erie that's technically in Canada, but perfect for Americans flush with booze money made during Prohibition. Rosita McGee, the wife of a gangster, has taken refuge there in her family's mansion, a butter-yellow confection of porticos and verandas and tall windows, along with her maid, Aurelia Escalante. The accidental death of Rosita's child in a gunfight has turned the island sanctuary into a place of sadness, not just for Rosita, but also for Aurelia, who's in hiding from an act of violence that permanently altered her life. Then Rosita's unpleasant husband, Eddie, sails up to the dock in his yacht with a coterie of crooks in tow, including one with grudges to burn. Eddie's come to tell his wife they're selling the island. Naturally, it doesn't take long for a body to turn up. The sheer number of ways in which all the characters lie to other people and to themselves is breathtaking. Short, in her first standalone novel, handles every element with aplomb, showing how losing a loved one can corrode the brain like nothing else. The reviewer, Sarah Weinman, is the author of Scoundrel and The Real Lolita. Weinman writes the monthly crime and mystery column for the New York Times Book Review. The Icon and the Idealist, Margaret Sanger, Mary Ware Dennett, and the Rivalry That Brought Birth Control to America, by Stephanie Gorton. This book was reviewed by Clara Bingham. In the days after Donald Trump's election, abortion pill providers were inundated with orders for mifepristone and misoprostol. This desire to hoard is not only understandable, but just plain smart. The new national prescription is quite clear. In 2023, J.D. Vance, the vice president-elect, suggested their administration would resurrect the Comstock Act, the long-dormant federal law that makes it unlawful to put abortifacients in the mail. If Margaret Sanger, from 1879 to 1966, and Mary Ware Dennett, 1872 to 1947, knew that their nemesis, Anthony Comstock, the anti-vice crusader and longtime U.S. postal inspector, still had the power to threaten America women's reproductive rights in the year 2024, they would be spinning in their respective graves. In her gripping double biography of these two foremothers of the American birth control movement, The Icon and the Idealist, Stephanie Gorton skillfully depicts the grueling decades-long struggle of Sanger, the icon in this telling, and Dennett, the idealist, to make birth control available and legal. Gorton, a journalist and writer, delivers a suspenseful recounting of the two activists' myriad campaigns, trials, and imprisonments as they battled the country's puritanical leadership, their commitment to saving women's lives nothing short of heroic. It is also a haunting reminder that a century later, women are still battling the entrenched forces of misogyny. The author also describes the painful, destructive rivalry between her two subjects with narrative nuance and scholarly acumen. Using previously unpublished letters and manuscripts, she offers the reader an emotionally palpable glimpse into the culture clash between the feminist movement and the patriarchal, recalcitrant political establishment, as well as the struggle between the ideological allies Sanger and Dennett. Sanger's story has passed into legend. On a hot summer day in 1912, as she told it, she rushed to a tenement in Lower Manhattan in response to a call from a panicked husband trying to revive his unconscious wife, injured by a self-induced abortion. When a doctor successfully revived Sadie Sachs, the couple asked him how they would prevent another pregnancy. "Tell Jake to sleep on the roof," replied the doctor. 3 months later, Sanger returned to the same apartment to find that same mother of three in a coma, having attempted the same procedure. This time, Sachs died, and Sanger became radicalized. Even Mary and William Hartley Dennett, a college-educated Massachusetts couple, knew little about the basic mechanics of fertility. After Mary nearly died while giving birth to her third child in 1905, the family's doctor informed them that another pregnancy would risk her life. But the doctor neglected to give the Dennetts any information about contraception. "I was utterly ignorant of the control of conception, as was my husband also," wrote Dennett years later. After years of forced abstinence, the Dennetts divorced and Mary moved to New York to work for the National American Women's Suffrage Association. Even though his mother had bled to death after giving birth to her 10th child when he was a little boy, Anthony Comstock, who lived from 1844 to 1915, abhorred anything that limited a woman's sacred duty of motherhood. After he was installed as the first chief agent of the New York City for the suppression of vice, Comstock arrested abortionists and banned newspapers, books, photographs, and art that contained any sex or nudity. Reeling from a corruption scandal and seeking redemption, Congress passed Comstock's censorious bill in 1873. The Comstock Act prohibited mailing anything considered obscene, including medical devices used for birth control and abortion or written references to the same. What followed was decades of what Gorton terms a great silencing, as this federal law dealt a chilling blow to free speech. Undeterred by the vice police and hell-bent on helping women control their fertility, Sanger edited a militant monthly publication called The Woman Rebel, in which she published information about birth control options as well as her manifesto, deemed radical for declaring simply that a woman's body belongs to herself alone. It does not belong to the United States of America. "Enforced motherhood," she went on, "is the most complete denial of a woman's right to life and liberty." The Woman Rebel presented a direct challenge to the Comstock Act, and in 1914, agents arrested Sanger and charged her with 4 counts of criminal violations of the Act. Rather than face trial and a potential 40-year sentence, Sanger fled the country. While Sanger was in exile in London, a group of suffragists, socialists, and settlement house workers, including Mary Dennett, founded the National Birth Control League in March 1915 with the goal of repealing both the New York State and federal Comstock laws. When Sanger returned to the United States a year later to face trial, she expected to be embraced by the League. She wasn't. In the first salvo of power struggle that would define their relationship for decades, Dennett showed Sanger the door. Unbowed, in 1916, Sanger opened the country's first birth control clinic in the poor immigrant neighborhood of Brownsville, Brooklyn. On their first day of operation, a line of more than 100 women, many accompanied by husbands and children, snaked around the block. The clinic stayed open for 9 days and served 464 patients before the police blocked the doors and arrested Sanger and her staff for violating state obscenity laws. She stood trial, was convicted, and served 30 days in a workhouse in Queens. A year before women gained the right to vote, Dennett moved to Washington and began the uphill battle of lobbying a hostile Congress to delete the contraception section from the Comstock Act. As if Dennett didn't have enough trouble getting through to the squeamish, dismissive representatives, her efforts were soon undermined by Sanger, who began lobbying for an entirely different bill. Sanger and Dennett had almost nothing in common. Sanger was attractive and glamorous. Dennett was homely and unassuming. Sanger had romantic affairs with men on both sides of the Atlantic and married a rich one who funded her life and activism. Dennett lived alone in a walk-up in Queens. In an unfortunate show of accord, both saw the political advantage of partnering with a popular racist anti-immigration eugenics movement. Sanger wooed them more aggressively than Dennett, and as a result tarnished her legacy. Planned Parenthood took Sanger's name off their Manhattan clinic in 2020. Eventually, victory for both women and the movement came not with legislation, but from dramatic legal verdicts. In 1930, an appeals court ruled that Dennett's distribution of her explicit sex education pamphlet, The Sex Side of Life, did not violate the Comstock Act's obscenity laws. 7 years later, Sanger's victory in United States versus one package of Japanese pessaries dealt another blow to the Comstock Act by allowing doctors to obtain contraceptive devices through the mail. As if to prove that progress never trends in a straight line, Gorton's riveting history of the first movement to grant women control over their bodies is essential reading now more than ever. The reviewer Clara Bingham's most recent book is The Movement, How Women's Liberation Transformed America, 1963 to 1973. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.